Well, hello. Welcome to the Josh Holiday Show on your computer, your radio, your internets, whatever. It is the 27th of December, 2009. We're inching towards the new year. I am calling this podcast number three, though technically it is podcast number four. Last week we did a special Christmas slash holiday edition of the podcast. We call it the Josh Holiday Holiday Extravaganza, and go and have a listen to it if you please. It is at joshholidayshow.com, and it's fun. Good times. We had a 87-year-old lady call in and try and flirt with me. We talked to a drunken, bitter, jaded, angry Santa, a mall Santa, and we also talked to a stripper by the name of Candy Kane. So go back and check that out. Otherwise, let's get going with this week's podcast. I guess we're in that lull now between Christmas and New Year's. The all right, Christmas is done, but oh, guess what's coming? New Year's. Woo woo woo. Although I'm not like a giant New Year's, like, oh, we got to go to a club and party. I'm not a huge clubby guy. And that's been the case for many, many years. I would rather go to just generally between a pub and a club, hands down, always choose the pub or the bar over the not a fan of that stuff. So yeah, New Year's, still working on plans. I've found that in the past, the best New Year's Eves have been those spent with close friends, sometimes family, and no matter where you are, whether it's at a house or at some sort of event. But I find they also, the clubs or the bars, pretty much every bar, jacks up the price on everything for that one night a year, which is sort of pathetic. There are some places that are exceptions. Like, I've been to pubs where, when the New Year's rolls around, it's just like, well, we're just doing what we're doing. You can come in and buy drinks, and they get packed, and they make money through booze. But then there's the ones that are like, $100 gets you a glass of cheap champagne at midnight and party horns. That's not a good deal. Anyway, Christmas. It was a good one, fairly low-key here in Toronto, with just basically my parents and my aunt came over, so just the four of us. And this was, I guess, proof that my mom doesn't listen to this show. I opened up a gift, and it was soft cotton, sort of slightly flannelly, and it looked like a pair of boxer shorts. And it was a pair of boxer shorts with a pattern on it that had sort of some skulls and the word kill scattered on the pattern, and then in fancy gold writing that had been what's that word I'm looking for? Silk screened. Yes, gold writing that had been silk screened on the front lower leg of these boxer shorts. Ed Hardy. And it also, for good measure, it said it on the waistband, because if you're going to wear the Ed Hardy, you know, hopefully maybe your waistband will be a little low and people can see that you're wearing this luxurious brand. So you can tell people, look at me, I am so fucking cool. No, I'm sorry, but Ed Hardy is not cool. And it was sort of tough because you don't want to seem like you're ungrateful. But it's such irony because there's so many times I've talked about it on here and in just in general about how ridiculous Ed Hardy is and how it tends to be the clothing of choice for douchebags everywhere, worldwide. Even when I was over in Turkey and Greece, there it was, Ed Hardy. But, I have talked about this in the past. Christian Odigier, whatever, he created the Ed Hardy brand. I believe he's based on a tattoo artist, but he's created that brand. And he also created Von Dutch. So he's been responsible for two of the douchiest brands in the history of mankind. And the Ed Hardy thing is getting out of control. There's Ed Hardy cologne, Ed Hardy this, Ed Hardy that. And it, I don't think it ever really was cool. I think by the time it came out, it was already, people had had enough of the Scully stuff. And now, I mean, I'm certainly, there's people probably who wear or who have worn Ed Hardy who were naive to the fact that it's, it was hugely douchey. Like, I've seen people around who seem like friendly people, oblivious to the fact that Ed Hardy clothing basically symbolizes douchivity. And I guess that's the case with my mom, because I was like, yeah, I sort of make fun of these. And she said, oh, I hadn't heard of them. This is the first time I saw it. It looked kind of cool. And it's like, no. And I think Ed Hardy's gotten to the point now where in the past, you could give people a pass for wearing this line of clothing. You might say, well, they don't know any better. But the grace period is over. If you're wearing Ed Hardy, you're a douche. I'm sorry. I think the media has brought that to everyone's attention, that with their glowing examples, you're John Gosselin. He's almost the spokesperson for Ed Hardy. He's a major douche, and that's his brand of choice. So if you're seeing that, you might think, oh, yeah, okay, that's what douches wear. And now, with the advent of Jersey Shore, the show about douchebags, Ed Hardy clothing plays a very, very prominent role in that show. And the guys on that show are douchebags. They're actually prime examples of douchebags. And the weird thing is, I mentioned this to some friends from Calgary, because I lived there for 2 years doing a radio show, but Jersey Shore, when I watch it, it sort of reminds me of Calgary to a certain degree. And someone called me on it. They said, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's not right. I said, I'm just saying there's a larger than normal proportion of guys who are fake tattooed, have bad tribal tattoos, wear Ed Hardy, and have that whole kind of douchey attitude, sort of the Jersey Shore attitude. In Calgary. And same thing with Jersey Shore, though, on the female side. There's a lot of women in Calgary who have the fake tans, the giant fake boobs, and just sort of that whole attitude of like, oh, yeah, Paris Hilton, great, blah, blah, blah. So therein lies the comparison. There's plenty of decent people in Calgary and smart people, but there's definitely a lot of Jersey Shore types, douchies, as I like to call them. So there we go. Yeah, the grace period is over. If you have a friend who's wearing the Ed Hardy, or someone you know, take some time out and educate them on their choice. And maybe they're proud of it. Then I would say just avoid them, because they'll probably get angry, maybe get into a roid rage and attack you. But if you know someone who's innocently wearing the brand, you may want to try and explain to them the folly of their ways. All right, that's it for Ed Hardy. It's that time of year. I've been bombarded with it. I read all the papers. I like to read papers in the actual classical form on paper. I know, it's weird. And magazines as well. Everyone is doing their end of year list this time of year, but it's explosive. It's doubly explosive because it's also the end of the decade. So not only are you getting year end lists, oh, the best of 2010, oh, it was fantastic. You're also getting the aughts, the 2010, 10 years of the 2000s, what was the best, what was the worst, the music, the films, the TV, the comedy, the books, the magazines, the stories that rocked us, the scandals that plagued us. There's a whole, my mom got for Christmas this magazine, I think it's a People magazine, but it's, it recaps all the scandals, but it goes all the way back to, like, you know, Princess Diana. But there's a certain part of me that has that voyeuristic, it's just kind of gross and gossipy, but you're kind of curious nonetheless. But scandal and gossip seems to be the theme of the last few years of this decade, with your TMZs and your Paris Hiltons. Anyway, I'm going to fall in the trap a little bit. Not with a gossipy thing, but with a year-end list. Just one. I'm a huge, huge fan of movies. I try and go as often as I can. It seems like at least once a week. And I've seen a lot of the movies this year that have been critically acclaimed, some less so, and try and go to as many movies as possible. And as I've probably mentioned on here before, I use Rotten Tomatoes as sort of a guide. If you go to RottenTomatoes.com, they basically take the critical mass, critics from around the world, and they mash it all up and give you a percentage of positive versus negative reviews. So 60% positive and up, so 60% to 100% positive reviews will garner you a fresh rating. Anything under 60% counts as rotten. So it's a good rule of thumb for checking out movies. If it's under 60, you may be like, I don't know. Unless it's a project that maybe you know that you might specifically like because there's someone in it that you're a huge fan of, or it may just be to certain tastes. But generally, it's a very good way to go and check out movies, or vet them at the very least before you go and see them. I haven't seen every movie of the critically acclaimed variety this year, so I'll throw that out there right away. I'm not a movie critic who gets paid to see every single movie that's out. So right off the bat, I haven't seen Up in the Air yet, though I've heard fantastic things about it. Also haven't seen Precious, so I'll throw that out there to begin with. But I'm going to give you a top 10. These are in no particular order, but 10 movies that stood out for me this past year. I will start out with The Hurt Locker, which is not a huge surprise. It's making a lot of top 10 lists. In a lot of cases, the very top of the list, and already it's garnered quite a bit of critical acclaim and has been named best film by various critic circles, the New York, the LAs, that type of thing. And it deserves all the praise it gets. It's a fantastic film. Catherine Bigelow directed it, and it is a war movie, but it's hard to sort of explain. It's sort of intimate in a lot of ways. There's suspense, there's tension, there's camaraderie, and it really captures the chaos of the situation in Iraq. And it basically follows a group of guys whose mission it is. They're the part or the department of the military that is called upon to disable improvised explosive devices, IEDs, which is, as you can imagine, a hugely dangerous job. And psychologically, you can imagine what doing that day-to-day does and the fact that you're on the front lines. It's just a really, really amazing film and done in a really great way. And a good look at the Iraq War. Not in a rah-rah America way, but more of a personal way. All right, that's The Hurt Locker. No particular order. I'm just throwing 10 films that I really, really like this year out. An Education. I just saw this one a few weeks ago, and it's a British film adapted from an actual memoir, and the screenplay was done by Nick Hornby, who has a pretty good track record, and it's a bit of a Lolita-like tale. It's about this British private school girl who's 16, and this older gentleman, played by Peter Sarsgaard, American with a British accent, and they basically meet, and he tries to sort of charm her, and she's at school, I guess, a bit of an outsider, so a little bit more vulnerable to the charms of Sarsgaard, who is charming but creepy at the same time. He does a really, really fantastic job, and the girl in the film is played by Carey Mulligan, who to this point hasn't really had any leading roles, but she does a fantastic job in this movie, and I believe she'll be nominated for Academy Awards, those types of things. Maybe she already has been. I don't know. Has the awards gone out? Am I that out of the loop? Or the nomination's gone out? I don't know if I'm that out of the loop. But in any case, it looks like she's getting more prominent work. I know she's in the Wall Street sequel, and she's dating Shia LaBeouf, so whatever that's worth. But she's really, really good, and it's a great film. If you're thinking, oh, that sounds like a chick flick, it's not. It's just a really, really great movie. And our friend Sean Tabaris, he will not see it. He's like, ooh, he makes fun of it because I guess he's seen the trailer. So he's like, oh, I don't want to go to school. I want to, but he is missing out. He thinks it's too girly, but he's missing out on a great film. That's An Education. Another one of my top 10 choices for movies for 2009. In no particular order. 500 Days of Summer. Another one where you might think, I don't know, it's kind of a chick flick romance, but it's really, really well done. It's not your typical sappy, you know, there's no Sandra Bullock or no, I don't know who's a romantic, there's no Anne Hathaway. It's sort of a really great indie feeling romance movie, and it's not all a bed of roses. There's unrequited love, which I think everyone, especially me, could identify with. And I would call it a charming movie. It's very charming and quirky. The soundtrack is really good as well. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is good in this, and Zoe Deschanel. You kind of fall in love with her just watching the movie, but yeah, it's just a good. I don't want to call it a love story because it's sort of unrequited love story. See it. You will enjoy it. 500 Days of Summer. One of the 10 movies on my list in no particular order. Anvil. The documentary about Anvil. I really like this one. We saw it at the Bloor Cinema. And actually two of the super fans, I guess, that are chronicled in the movie, in the Anvil movie, were actually... they're watching. We saw them on the way out, so it was kind of funny. It's about, if you're not totally familiar with the movie, it's about a Canadian heavy metal band that was popular in the 80s. They seem like they were destined for huge things along your sort of Metallica, Judas Priest type lines, and they were playing giant festivals with bands like that back in their heyday. And then there's no real explanation of why they stopped being popular. It just sort of went a different direction. And there's all kinds of celebrity musicians of the hard rock variety who are fans of Anvil, and who you know lend some testimony in this particular film. I was really disappointed that they put out the short list films that were available to be nominated for Academy Awards, and Anvil did not make the list, so it won't be one of the nominations for an Oscar, which is too bad because it really, really is a fantastic film. It's like people have described it a bit as a real life Spinal Tap, although I think there's more humanity to it and more, I guess you feel more sympathy for the band. Though it's a great story because they don't give up on their dream, and I think the irony or it's sort of fortuitous that since the documentary has come out, they have seen a newfound success. So their failed success that's documented in the film has created new successes for the band. They've been making the rounds of talk shows and have been given some opening gigs for very large venues for fairly prominent bands. So Anvil, the documentary, I believe it's out on DVD now, so you might want to check that out. I am counting the top 10 movies for me for the last year, not in any particular order. Not a countdown or count up. It's just random movies that I liked, and there's 10 of them. Zombieland. Now, I'll put it right out there right now. I'm not by any means a zombie geek. I'm not one of those zombie nerds who's like, oh, I gotta go see zombies. Oh, zombies this, zombies that. I know people like that. I like people like that. They're friends, but I'm ambivalent when it comes to zombies and movies, and I didn't go on the zombie walk, though I saw pictures and looked at them with curiosity. So I went into this movie with no real expectations. I almost was sort of reluctant to see it because I run hot and cold with Woody Harrelson to begin with, and then the whole zombie thing, I was like, I don't know, there's been so many zombie movies. So I went in pretty neutral on it. And was really pleasantly surprised. Woody Harrelson was good and sort of well suited to his role. And the movie was done a little tongue in cheek, and it was clever. It was actually fun. It wasn't just zombies eating people. Well, look at that. There was a real sense of humor to it and a different take on the genre. The opening credits alone were worth the admission. And Jesse Eisenberg is in, he's actually in two of my top 10 movies. There's another one coming up that he was a lead in. Zombieland. It was a little campy, a little silly. There's some romance and a creative film. And creativity goes a long way. In my book, I don't have an actual book, but my mind is a book. And if you look, if you were able to slice it open with some kind of brain-slicing gadget, you would open it up and see in large letters, creative, because it's very big in my book. Does that make any sense at all? Probably not, but whatever. Okay, we're continuing the 10 movies that I enjoyed this year. The Hangover. I like movie voice, guys. I miss Don LaFontaine. He didn't die this year, I don't think. He died, I think, last year. But he was the big movie voice guy. The In a time, one man stood against the world. I can't do him. The Hangover. I've been a fan of Zach Galifianakis for quite a long time. His stand-up and his performance pieces. He's a genuinely funny guy. And saw the trailer for this months and months before the movie came out, and right away I was like, oh, this one's going to be good. It's my kind of movie. A lot of fun. Trailer was awesome, and sometimes you think, oh, can it live up to the hype of the trailer? And in this case, it did, and it surpassed it. Pretty much laughing out loud through the whole movie, which is always a good thing. And the weird thing about the movie is I don't even know his name, but the guy who is getting married, the groom who they take to Las Vegas for his, stag party, his pre-wedding celebration. You see him at all the premieres and stuff, and yet he's pretty much a bit player in the movie because he's at the beginning with a wife and he leaves. And then for all of the hijinks, yes, I just used the word hijinks. I know, I'm sorry. For all the stuff that goes on during the bulk of the movie, the fun stuff, he's disappeared. And then when all the fun's over, he reappears. So you kind of feel badly for the guy because this is a huge project. And, you know, you're one of the so-called stars. You're one of the guys who go to Vegas. But you're not found. You're the reason people are having adventures, but you have no adventures on your own. And I know there's a sequel in the works, so I wonder how involved he'll be when they make the sequel. I don't know. I can't remember the scenarios that they've posited, but like we'll wait and see. So you hope when a movie's really, really good the first time, it's tough to make it a decent sequel without disappointing people. So we'll wait and see. I'll reserve judgment. We'll make a reservation. I will call the maitre d' of judgment, and I will make a reservation. I will reserve judgment. Another great story about the film is the director, when he was putting the film together, he took it to the movie studio, and he didn't have, there's no leading man, or at that point, no leading man for the movie. Bradley Cooper, not really well known at all prior to The Hangover. So the movie studio was like, well, you know, we're not going to throw you a ton of money, you know, maybe. And so the director said that he would take points in the film, which means that rather than taking a decent paycheck up front for making the movie, he waived his paycheck and said, well, okay, well, I will get a certain percentage of the gross of the movie. And because the studio is not expecting, you know, sort of a comedy romp to make a ton of money, especially because there's no leading man in it, they agree and give him a really decent percentage of the film. So then the film opens and does huge, huge business and continues to do huge business. You know, one of the biggest comedies of all time. The director, it's almost like winning the lottery. Like millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars because he decided to take a percentage of the gross. That's the movie the money makes, you know, dollar one before it gets, you know, wheeled down to paying back, paying people. He gets dollar one. He got a ton of money. It's similar to what happened years and years ago with the Batman that Jack Nicholson was in. He said, "Well, I'll just take a piece of the action." So he might have gotten for his small like 3-day role, if he was just to take a paycheck, they might have given him like $3 million. But because he took a points in the movie, he made closer to $60 million for a 3-day role in the Batman movie. So there you go. The Hangover is one of my top 10 movies of the last year. And I'm, as I mentioned, I'm not doing it in any particular order. It's just random 10 movies I really enjoyed and think you too might enjoy. The next one, I was late to the, well, I don't know, I'm looking for some cliche, but I didn't check it. I didn't see this movie when it first came out. That's what I'm looking for a cliche for. Late to the game, maybe? Yeah, that's when that works. Okay. Anyway, the movie came out, and I waited like 2 months or 3 months to see it, so I saw it more recently. Where the Wild Things Are. And this movie seemed to be a bit divisive because there's a lot at stake in terms of people's childhood memories. Everyone's like, oh, they better not ruin it, better not be bad. And there's been a lot of anticipation for the movie. I remember, you know, stills would come out or a small piece of the film would come out, you know, a year ago, and people would be like, oh, my God, it's out. This looks like it's going to be great, or oh, no. Personally, I didn't have a huge attachment to the Morris Sendak book. I'd read it as a child, but the memory of it is very, very vague. As are a lot of my childhood memories. I'm not one of those. I don't have a great long-term memory. But in any case, I saw the movie, and I actually saw it with my friend Gene, and we both came out of the theater, and he was like, eh, it was okay. And I really, really liked it, but I was sort of reluctant. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I liked it. But I didn't want to, you know, get in any kind of, like, big debate. I was just like, all right, he didn't really like it, but it hit me more than him. And I think that was the case for a lot of people. I think it sort of polarized people. Some people were like, eh, didn't live up to my expectations. And some people were really charmed by it. And I fit into that latter category of being charmed. Spike Jonze directed it. And he's an interesting character when it comes to films, you know, that you're being John Malkovich. He always makes interesting movies. And you would never guess that, oh, he's also one of the main creators, directors of the Jackass franchise. So he's a really well-rounded director. But I think he did a lot of things in this movie right. And one of the main things that I thought was great is as much as possible, he avoided using CGI, computer graphic images, to make the films. Which that's the one thing that drives me crazy. CGI, I still don't think has quite gotten to the point where it's real or feels real. I like the old school, you know, where stuff was, you know, you could feel like Jaws, the original Jaws. That was great. They could have, in these days they might do it with CGI and it just wouldn't feel the same, but it just, like having something physical there, it has sort of an indescribable, you just know it's more real. Same thing with like any kind of alien movie. I like a realness. I don't like CGI very much. So when Spike Jonze made this movie, he set out to try and avoid using CGI as much as possible. And he did end up using it for some of the facial expressions, but the actual creatures were all giant costumes, and that's what made it great, too. It's very, it's sort of a childlike experience, and having giant sort of puppet-like creatures, it's a very, very childhood-friendly thing. I don't know. I was really taken in by it. And just the way he created a whole different world. And each of the creatures were great. I thought Catherine O'Hara in particular was really, really fantastic. And the way that they put the movie together was also kind of unique. Rather than just sort of sitting around a bunch of microphones in a studio voicing the creatures, Spike Jonze had them go in this big barn and actually play, you know, act out their actions and play and become the creatures. So I think it lent a little bit more realism to the performance as well. And I don't know, I just came away from the movie kind of touched. It's just kind of a tender movie. So there you go. That is Where the Wild Things Are on my list of 10 movies I enjoyed this year, no particular order. Here's one that, another one that's was pretty divisive. And all right, I'll just put it out there. Bruno. Bruno was one of my favorite movies of the last year. It got kind of critically... It didn't do horribly critically. It wasn't like on Rotten Tomatoes, it wasn't like a 30%. I think it hovered around the 60, but it just... Critics didn't seem to like it, and word of mouth for the movie really did it some harm. Like it the first night it opened really big, I think, because people were like, "Oh, Borat, I like Borat, I'm going to like this." But after that, it just seemed to tank a little bit. I was kind of disappointed, and I was trying to figure out why. Is it that it's not that funny, or is it just because the material makes people uncomfortable? Because it really does put the whole it waves its cock in your face, both literally and figuratively. But the way I just judge comedies are by how much I laugh during them. And I laughed start to finish during Bruno. I was laughing. It was a really, really funny movie. And I'm still can't quite get my head around why people didn't really like the movie. If you know, maybe get in touch with me and let me know. JoshHolidayShow.com. Tell me. We will have a discussion. A conversation. I think Sacha Baron Cohen is a genius. I was a big fan of the Ali G show when it first came out. I owned the DVDs and watched them and introduced tons of people. It's one of those shows where you're like, oh, you got to see this. So I'd make everyone who hadn't seen it, I would make watch it. And just some brilliant, brilliant comedy. So you saw the early days of Bruno, of Borat, and Ali G, and it's similar in style, in that it's a character interacting with real people to get kind of interesting reactions. But the one thing that sort of frustrates me is after Borat, because it was so popular, he had to retire that character because everyone knows, everyone would be wise to the act. So it was sort of disappointing because it was so great for so long. And in this case, Bruno, it's now done. And I saw it in the theater, but I recently bought the DVD used because the commentary is with Larry Charles, the director and a pretty brilliant writer, director. It's with him and with Sacha Baron Cohen, not in character, but as Sacha Baron Cohen. And they reveal which stuff people were in on and not in on. I still haven't watched it and listened to the commentary, but I'm looking forward to that because Sacha Baron Cohen generally tries to avoid talking about his characters as himself. Usually if he makes interview appearances, it's usually in character, and you don't really get behind the scenes of the movies so much as an extension of the movie. So I'm really looking forward to getting an insider's look at how they put this thing together. So that's Bruno. That's probably the one that on my list where people will say, "What? What are you thinking? What is wrong with you?" But let me know. Get in touch with me, please, because I really want to know people who didn't like this film, what the main reason was. All right, another one. This one also stars Jesse Eisenberg, as did Zombieland. And it also has land in the title. Zombieland, Adventureland. Adventureland. Greg Mottola directed it. It takes place in 1987. And they found this this amusement park that had gone out of business, I believe in upstate New York, that they used to film it. And I'm a really big fan of Dazed and Confused, which I thought really, really captured the feel of that sort of 70s high school pre-university thing. And in that same way, Adventureland captures it for the 80s. John Hughes movies sort of capture the 80s, but they were made during the 80s. This one is sort of a nostalgic look back, and there's something about amusement parks. There's a certain magic to them, even when they're closed. I'm going to go off on a tangent quickly here, but I found a website one time where it was where people had taken pictures of various different amusement parks, some of them in the South and through the States that had been abandoned and just left, not destroyed, but just abandoned and left to rot. I guess they went out of business or whatever. But there's a certain kind of, I don't know what the word is, not creepiness, but an eeriness. I'm not sure what the word is, but there's still sort of Oh, the wordsmith. I don't know. There's something magical about amusement parks after they've been abandoned. But in this case, the amusement park was working for the movie and has some romance and some adventure. And it's funny and it's tender and it's a nice movie. Adventureland is one of the ones on my top 10 for 09. All right, next up. District 9. This one had a brilliant, brilliant marketing campaign. It was not marking anything. It had a brilliant marketing campaign, and especially in the transit where they would have posters saying humans only, no, blah, blah, blah. It was a really well done film, and especially the marketing. So there was a lot of hype going into it, and I went in, and I was actually after maybe the first 30 minutes, I was like, I felt like I was being disappointed because they were establishing that the parallels to apartheid in South Africa and segregation, and they were doing a documentary style, and that was for the first half hour. It was all about that. And you did see the main protagonist and see him dealing with all these things. But it got to a point where I was like, okay, that's, yes, I get it. This is those parallels and this is a whole, sort of a different world that's similar. But then it turned for me. The lead character, they spend that 30 minutes as well as exposition because they want you to get to know him and to like him because he's the guy you're going to follow through the film and either root for or dislike. And, once we get into where there's actual a personal investment and he becomes involved and there's emotions involved, then the movie really, really took off for me. I really, really enjoyed it. And it was pretty amazing hybrid. I mean, obviously some social commentary, but there's action and it was just really good. It almost reminded me a little bit, parts of the film, reminded me of The Fly, David Cronenberg's film, where Jeff Goldblum slowly became Brundlefly. And even though he turned into this creature, you still sort of saw through it and saw some humanity, and you felt sympathy for the creature. So District 9, it's another one of the ones. Oh, look, that's I've come to 10. I'd recap if I had all these sheets here, but that's fine. You know what? I will. District 9, Hurt Locker, An Education. What else is on my list here? Sorry, it's all paper. Bruno. Adventureland. And obviously District 9 we've covered. Anvil, the documentary. Zombieland, The Hangover. What else is here? Boom, 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 boom. Do you like the sound of shuffling papers as much as I do? Where the Wild Things Are. And one thing I want to mention, 500 Days of Summer. That's not the one thing, but that's on the list. All right. Is there one more that I had in there? No. The one movie I saw this year that I felt like kind of walking out, I was just so like, ugh, this drives me crazy. One that I had high expectations for. Dave Eggers helped write the screenplay. Sam Mendes directed the film. So there's, right away, two of the best at the biz, right? Dave Eggers, one of the best writers in the biz. Not necessarily filmic, but generally a great writer. Sam Mendes, one of the best directors in the biz. And then the actors, both fairly likable. Maya Rudolph, her first big dramatic role in John Krasinski from The Office, also a fairly likable guy. So I went in thinking, oh, this might be kind of a fun, kind of quirky movie. Even though it sort of, I think the ratings for or the reviews for it were around it's like 60% positive, and I'd seen some reviews that really liked it, but it got to the point watching the movie, I became irritated and agitated, and I was watching it with my friend Gene, and I was like, I think we were on the same page, especially after we became like angry about the movie, telling everyone don't go see this movie. It just for me it seemed like pretentious, like really trying too hard to, you know, it's about this narcissistic couple. And it's just really, really pretentious, annoying movie. Yes. Did I even say the name of the movie? Away We Go. Yeah, not a good movie. And the funny thing is now I'm hyper aware of these end of year things. I noticed that it's made a few worst of the year lists, which is good. And the weird thing is, I think it might. I'm sure somewhere it's made a few best of the year lists, because I'm sure there's some pretentious critics who are like, oh, this is a masterpiece. But no, it's not good. All right. You know what? I'm going to play some comedy here. Take a break from me blibberty blabbering about the movies. I'm going to play something from the Sklar Brothers. They are twin brothers. They have a couple of comedy albums out. And I thought this one was fun because it takes a poke at a radio format. I'm from the radio. I've done radio stuff. So maybe it's more funny to me than others. But here's the Sklar Brothers, twin brothers, their take on classic rock.
Yeah, we love classic rock radio stations.
Because of the pageantry, right? They have to go crazy and name their morning shows. That's it.
That's
and someone
opinion.
Told somebody at a classic rock radio format that crazy equals cool.
Crazy's cool.
So they're always like the moaning asylum.
It's like a nut house in here.
Woo, look at crazy shirtless Ron.
Woo.
Look at him, he's on the radio.
That doesn't make
sense.
You can't
see him, right? Now here's the one that's in every city. We had it growing up, and I think it's hilarious because it really doesn't make sense, is the Crazy Morning Zoo.
They're saying they're as crazy as a zoo.
Really? That's a failed premise.
Because when you think about it, a zoo is like the most fucking controlled environment in the world.
Yes. What are you saying? We're as crazy as a train that goes 2 miles an hour.
Yeah.
It's like a zoo in here.
It's like a zoo in here. We're as crazy as a bunch of sad animals.
Sitting on a bunch of fake rocks and dreaming about their natural habitat. We're as crazy as an underpaid employee having to give a hippo an enema. That's my question. Why are classic rock radio stations still around today?
How are they still alive?
How are they still
alive? They should be dead.
Because they have a finite number of songs that they can play.
Like four.
Four songs. It's Freebird, Time by Pink Floyd, a Zeppelin tune, and then Freebird again.
That's all they've got, people.
They're looping it, dude.
They're looping.
But they're trying to get new listeners. And the way they're doing it is they have these ridiculous over-the-top commercials on their own radio station, promoting their own radio station. You know those commercials with the deep sort of godlike omniscient voice?
They're like, you're listening to classic rock, you pussy.
Pussy?
Come on, dude.
You want me to listen to that?
Why would you call me a pussy?
When we grew up in St. Louis, we had the best classic rock radio station ever, KSHE 95. It's been around for like 35 years.
It's hilarious.
They have the most over-the-top, most ridiculous
commercials promoting their own radio
station. We were just in St. Louis. We listened to KSHE 95. For a half hour straight, they played no music.
No more songs!
They've stopped playing music. All they did was play these station IDs back to back to back. Literally, for a half an hour, this is what we heard.
KSHE 95.
We're going to jam 2,000 watts of classic rock and roll so far up your ass, you'll be coughing up Kenny Loggins.
Because we're KSHE 95, St. Louis's oval orifice of classic rock.
KSHE 95. We're going to tell your boss to fuck off. And then we're going to tell him it was from you. Because it's the weekend.
All weekend long.
But only right here on KSHE 95, St. Louis's festering caucus of classic rock.
KSHE 95, we're going to ask your ugly sister out for a date, but when she gets to the restaurant, we're not going to be there.
Because we'll be too busy counting down the top 500 classic rock hits of all time.
All throughout the month of Rocktober.
But only right here on KSHE 95, St. Louis's cum stained throw pillow of classic rock. KSHE 95, some stations may give you this.
Oops, I did it again.
But at KSHE 95, we're going to give you this.
Uten Grieben, Glauben, Globen.
KSHE 95, some stations may give you the Counting Crows.
Na 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 na, na 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 na, yeah.
But at KSHE 95, we're going to give you Journey.
Na 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 na.
KSHE 95, some stations may try and give you late breaking news.
Pussies.
But while they're doing that, we're going to give you a 4.5 hour heavy metal rock block.
Featuring Tesla,
Winger,
Striper,
Slayer,
Dokken,
Crocus,
and the Doobie Brothers.
KSHE 95, some stations may try and give you the sounds of the rainforest. Medication 95, we're going to need a side of a 286 Yamaha chainsaw ripping through your anal cavity like a hot knife through a well-marinated shoulder roast. Because Medication 95, we don't have time for women DJs
or Slobodan Milosa, bitch.
Because Medication 95 is a place where rock meets,
roll,
where the castle meets,
the dungeon,
where dick meets
balls.
Medication 95, set the station.
Rip off the knob.
Shove it up your ass.
Light it on fire.
And get ready to rock. And that is what we heard, literally, for half an hour straight.
That is the Sklar Brothers and their take on classic rock radio. It's Josh Holiday here. You're listening to me. I don't know how you're listening to me. Maybe it's on the internet. Maybe it's on CD. Maybe it's your iPod. Maybe who knows? But hello. If you want more information on the show, joshholidayshow.com. And now we're talking about end of year lists. I just ran through my top 10 movies, and not in no particular 10 movies I really liked from the last year. And I was thinking about television, but I thought, yeah, you know what? I don't watch enough television. I haven't sampled enough of the new shows to be able to give a great opinion on this. There's ones that I've been neglecting that I think I'll have to catch up on with DVDs. But I'm just going to throw out television shows that I enjoy and find are generally consistently good. Obviously, Mad Men, fantastic show. Got to wait for high definition for this one. Here in Canada, they ran on... I don't know what channel they ran it on here. AMC. They have the AMC channel here in Canada, but there's not an AMC high def channel. So you can either torrent the high definition one or go to the Rogers On Demand. That's what I did anyway here in Toronto. About a day or day and a half after they put up the high def version of the show. Rescue Me. That's a Dennis Leary fire rescue show. It's really one of the best shows on television that not enough people know about. They just finished, I think, the fifth season. Another show I kind of came to late through the power of DVDs. I actually watched the first season about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago. Boy, yeah, almost to the day, because I got it for Christmas, and then I started watching it thereafter. And then between now and then, I've watched all five seasons on DVD. And so just a really, really well-written show. Elements of drama, a lot of comedy, and it's just a really good show. Curb Your Enthusiasm. I like Seinfeld. My favorite character on Seinfeld was Costanza. And Curb Your Enthusiasm is basically you take Costanza, you amp him up, add some dirty, add some dark. And there you have it. The season was really good because there was a Seinfeld reunion type thing. 30 Rock. Don't have to tell you much about this, but every time I watch it, I'm in awe of the writing. It's a very, very well-written show. Daily Show. Well, every day, some good comedy. And probably the most incisive news program on television. Bored to Death. This show is brand new, and so far I've only seen 8 episodes. I think that might be it for this season. I was going to say really, really good show, but it's a grower. I watched an episode or two, and then I kind of let it go for a while, then I watched it again, and it's a funny show, but not in like a but more situational and quirky. Zach Galifianakis is one of the main characters. Jason Schwartzman is the lead character, so there's some Ted Danson in there, and if you give it some time and watch it for a while, it'll definitely grow on you. Another show from earlier in the season, from the spring, that I believe the second season is coming in the new year. Eastbound and Down is one of the it's just such a funny show, and Danny McBride, brilliant in it. And that one, if you haven't seen, get some DVDs and watch it. There's only 6 episodes, and there should be more in the spring. And a show that's been around for quite a while that I've just come to recently is Flight of the Conchords. It's weird in a way because I'd seen an episode here and there of the first season, but not really jumped into it full steam ahead. And every time I'd watched it, I thought, oh, this is kind of funny, but it never really grabbed me. Then I was on a flight back from St. John. I was out there for the Comedy Awards, and they had the on-demand stuff on the TVs on the planes. I thought, oh, yeah, I'll watch. I'm sitting here in my seat. I'm captive. There's not a lot of great stuff here, stuff that I haven't seen. So I put that on, and it was an episode with Kristen Wiig in it, and it was funny all the way through. And then I got home, and I you know, in short succession, watched the first and second season in a matter of a week or two. And it's just a funny, funny, brilliant show. And I'm kind of sad that they will not be coming back for a third season. I guess it's because it's a very music-based show, and they've run out of songs. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that, you know, maybe if it doesn't happen this year, it will happen eventually, that we'll see more Flight of the Conchords, because it's such a brilliant show. It'd be sad to see it go. So there, that's my TV stuff. Okay. Oh, just an update. Let me find this here. This is on the whole U2 thing. I'm just going to do this quickly. The last podcast I did, this is before the holiday special, I talked about how U2 and how Bono is a bit of a douche, because he's a hypocrite. More of a hypocrite than anything, because you know, he talks about ending world poverty and for governments to take action to spend money on different causes. Yet U2, the band that makes millions and millions and millions, maybe billions of dollars, has taken their company from Ireland and moved it offshore so that they don't have to pay taxes to the government. And so basically he's saying, yeah, government should do this and this and this and use your, you know, use the taxpayers' money, yet he's not willing to back it up with actually paying his taxes. So Bono was a douche. And then I got someone who didn't listen to the show, but they saw the status update saying the content of the show. This guy, Matt from Calgary, says, because I call Bono a douche, he says, it takes a douche to know one. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And then I asked if he was a YouTube fan. And he said, no, a U2 fan. And we all know what that band has done for music and to better the world. I don't know. What have they done to better the world? Yes, I know that Bono's ego is ridiculous, but that backs up the talent. And as a good friend said, who was also the LV for three bands, I'm not sure what that means, quote, if your talent is this big, then your head can be this big. Okay. So that is where I kind of laugh, because it's like saying, well, if you have a lot of talent, then you can afford to be an asshole, which is that's celebrity worship. That's giving celebrities a pass because they are celebrities or they're talented. OJ was a talented football player, and oh, he's a talented guy. He can afford to be a murderer. That's a bit extreme. But there's no excuse for bad behavior, whether it's just a regular guy, a plumber, a banker, a lawyer, a huge celebrity. No one needs to act like a douche or act like a hypocrite. That's all I'm saying. And that's, I mean, U2 is, in my opinion, hasn't been irrelevant for 10, 15 years. And I can't listen to Bono anymore because he is a giant hypocrite. I'm waiting for someone to call him on this, rather than being sycophantic, which seems to happen every time he's interviewed, is like, oh, kissing up to Bono. I'm just curious. And look at that. I had other stuff to talk about, amazingly. Usually I'm struggling to find stuff to fill the podcast with, but in this case, more than enough stuff. So I'm going to carry some stuff over till next week. I ask that you check out joshholidayshow.com, and please, if you have any comments on the show, anything you agree with or disagree with or maybe want to talk about, get in touch with me. And please check out the even though Christmas has passed, check out the special. I put a lot of work into it, and I think it's a lot of fun. I guess I will now bid you adieu, maybe. I feel like I should play some kind of theme song or something. Here, try this.
Please. That's the letter U and the numeral 2. The four-man band features Adam Clayton on bass, Larry Mullen on drums, Dave Evans, nicknamed The Edge, on... This is bullshit. Nobody cares. These guys are from England, and who gives a shit?
Oh, yeah.
Just a lot of wasted names that don't mean diddly shit.
I, for sure, you don't know where.
This is bullshit.
Sound like it's portable, yeah.
Who gives?
Nobody cares.
I'm getting stronger all the time here.
Snuggles.
Yeah.
Snuggles.
Oh, yeah.
Snuggles.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He was a little dog named Snuggles.
This is American Top 40. This is American Top 40. This is bullshit.
This is bullshit.